Welcome to the Teen Life Podcast, where we explore your questions to help you make meaningful connections with teenagers, because no teen deserves to feel alone. Today, we are wrapping up our series with Brenda McAdoo. And Brenda, we're just so thankful that you've taken the time to share your wisdom with us. I know me and Nino have really benefited
no doubt
from this conversation. And today we're wrapping up talking about kind of more handling crisis and conflict.
Yeah, which it's a great topic. Everybody needs it.
Yes. And so if you're out there listening, whether you work in a school or not, but I feel like especially for our school people, this is going to be a beneficial conversation. So the first question that I have is, how can adults recognize when a situation is serious enough to need outside intervention?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a difference between dealing with this with what kids say, but also dealing with this with what kids do. Because I think we talked about in a previous episode about being shockproof.
Right.
Well, lots of kids will say things, right, for shock value, or because they don't know what the consequences are of what they're saying, or how it's going to hit adults. Because adults have a vast amount of experience where we have dealt with trauma, we've dealt with pain, we've dealt with loss, we've dealt with suicide, we've dealt with, I mean, a million things, right? And so we take that experience and put it onto what kids say, but they don't. They don't have that as a backdrop to the things that they say. They're going to repeat something they heard on Instagram or YouTube, or they're going to retell a joke, right, that that just doesn't, it's not funny to adults because there's some morbidity to it. And we're seeing now a lot of kids with jokes that are what adults would be considered as inappropriate or morbid, right? But it's, they think it's funny. And so we have to remember, sometimes we've got to differentiate between behavior, right, that's actually going on in a kid, and the things that they say. So being shockproof first, because we're trying to determine, are they saying something that they don't understand or just for shock value, or is it something they really feel? And that's a hard thing, I think, for adults, especially, you know, whether it's your parent or you're in the school dealing with kids, you never want to dismiss what a kid says for the reason that it might be, you know, they might not understand or it might be shocking. We never want to dismiss, and we don't want to, I mean, especially maybe it's think about as outrageous or say, oh, it's just because they're being dramatic. Do we have kids that are dramatic? Absolutely. Right? Absolutely. But can we differentiate, I think, between a kid being dramatic, something terrible happening to them, and they don't know how to bring it up or discuss it. So they might tell you the really hard thing that happened to them as a an aside or almost with a laughing voice or a manner, because they're not sure how you're going to take it. Am I going to be believed by the adults who care about me? Am I going to be made fun of? All those things. So I know a family years ago whose daughter was sexually assaulted, and she came to tell her parents, and they didn't believe her. That caused them hurt and grief in that family for years. So can we differ? And because she said it with a kind of a laughing voice, and because she didn't know how to talk about it or what to say. And so they just dismissed it and thought that she was just trying to get attention. And so your question, right, begs, like, do we find some balance in how we talk to kids? And I'm going to bring it back to what all of our superpowers ought to be, is being curious. Can we ask questions? Can we give somebody, like, put down your phone, put down whatever you're doing, like, whatever it is. Lots of times kids tell us stuff when we're driving the car because they're not having to look us straight in the face, right? They're looking forward, so are we. But can you pull over? Can you get to the house and then have that conversation? And if you're at school, it's in the passing period, or it's right before the kids are going out to sports or for the day. And so then can you take the time to come back to them and be able to say, I really do want to talk to you about this? And I ask questions, not that are, you know, confrontational or judgmental, but questions that are truly open and then curious about what they're going to say. Because when kids give that information, especially in the words, right, they probably are asking for your help. They might say it like a statement and act like they don't need your help, but that's the cry for help. And so we do have to be able to be responsive in those areas. And then I will say in the behavior, right? How do we determine when we see certain behavior, whether or not we need to intervene? That I think is more important, right, to think about. So where kids are emotionally out of control and they can't control themselves and you can't help them, that would be a clue that you need to get help outside, mm-hmm. outside of your counselor session, or if you're a counselor at a school or a teacher-student relationship or even a parent. When emotions are so out of control that they either the crying can't be helped or the anger can't be helped and it doesn't diminish, there's something about, and there's a 90-second rule. So epinephrine runs through your body, you know, you get triggered or you get angry, and it runs through your system, that those chemicals that hit your brain run through your system about 90 seconds. If you have it beyond the 90 seconds, you've chosen to retain it. Mm. So because of that, if they've chosen to retain it or they can't control retaining, right, the anger or the high emotion, and you're not able to help them with any kind of de-escalation techniques or even just the your presence or that type of thing, then if that happens again and again, then you probably do need help outside you. That does not mean you need to go to a doctor and the police and like all that first. But it means you need to be willing, right, to talk to other people, to learn about it, to get some resources, because you don't want to wait too long until you have to take one of those steps, right? You're forced to. So I think anybody who deals with teens, can we be proactive before we're forced to be reactive?
Right.
That's good. So,
what does that look like? You're saying proactive. Is that, like, I'm trying to think in a school setting. Is that going to the police, or is it maybe just pulling in another adult so that you have some backup? Like, do you have any thoughts on what that would practically look like?
Yeah, I think, well, our schools, it kind of depends on your relationship with the school resource officer, right? There's some places where they're so integrated with the counselors and the teachers and the kids that they're a known, you know, quantity, and they're an adult that cares about the kids, right? That absolutely.
They're not going to be seen as a threat as much as a resource.
And so I think that a little bit depends in the schools about what that relationship looks like, but they are always a great resource, but there are tons of other resources, whether that is, learning about disorders, whether it is trying to figure out where are the places where I can go to get help for kids that have emotion. Do you start having in your office stress balls? Do you start having fidget things? Are you the teacher, counselor, person that has the ability to, like, pivot to something else? Mm-hmm. And I think that's – Do we have the ability to not always deal with the kids the exact same way? Mm. Well, if you can't get control of yourself, then you've got to go to the principal or I'm going to call the police or whatever. Can we have some steps that we can walk through with kids to give them the opportunity to regulate their own emotions and get back in a good place?
Right. I actually had a kid in one of my – well, he wasn't in my group. He was talking to the counselor right after my group, and he asked a question. He said, "Do you have something safe I can throw?" And I was like, what a good question. And she was distracted. And I was like, this isn't my office. I'm not about to hand you something to throw. But I was like, he recognized in that moment.
Yeah.
But you're right. If that's different than a kid just picking up something and throwing it, than being like, hey, I feel like I need to do something with my body.
Yeah.
But can we give them safe things to do
100%
when they feel that way?
And can we teach them to be self-aware to ask the question? Mm-hmm. I love that he was self-aware enough to ask that.
Right.
He recognized, I want to hit something. Mm-hmm. So now there's a wall, there's a person, right? But do you have something else I can throw that's safe? And he's probably been given that language from people who love him, right? Mm-hmm. So we have to be that for the kids. So that's like one of those, you know, squish balls, right, that just never break and they can hit anything. Or it's the, you know, the little Nerf, whatever. So, I mean, there are so many things that kids that can learn to do to help regulate themselves. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you get a little bit older as a teen, as an adult, and then you'll be thinking through like breathing and sensory things and all those things that we do to kind of manage our emotions, right? But man, could we have those things ready for kids, especially in the school setting or in the home?
So how, I'm going to back up a second, and I know we've talked about it prior to This whole 90-second rule, is there a way to make that overt to a teenager, or is that something that we just need to cognitively know and watch? Are they self-aware, to use that expression, enough to know that if 90 seconds they go this pivot this way or choose this way, is there a point in time where we can just say, dude, you got 90 seconds, what kind of decision you're going to make? Because after that is going to make a decision on what I get to do or have to do. Does that make sense?
I think giving kids language around it to be able to talk about it mm-hmm. and it not be like when they start to get mad. So you can teach kids language around being self-aware, right? That's fantastic. Like the kid asking, do you have something safe for me to throw? Being self-aware. But the other piece of it is actually being aware of what's happening in your body.
Mm-hmm.
So with my own kids, I would talk about, okay, you start to feel yourself getting angry. Where do you feel it? Because not everybody feels it in the same place. Mm. So I feel it right under my neck and I start getting, there's warmth first. Mm. And it's spreads. And if I don't recognize that, so some people feel it in the pit of their stomach, mm-hmm. some people feel it in the tension in their hands and their shoulders. Like there are different areas where people feel the physical effects of the chemicals hitting your brain and you getting angry or distressed or mm-hmm. whatever the strong emotion is.
Yeah.
And so I think if we can teach kids, how do you recognize in your body what's really happening? And can you do that to be able to then take a technique, right? Some mm-hmm. sort of coping mechanism to get you through the 90
That's
seconds.
Good.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so pivoting a little bit, you already mentioned managing emotions, de-escalation. So especially for maybe, because I think part of this is if you're an adult and you're in a situation where emotions are high, you're not only dealing with their emotions, you're also dealing with yours. Mm-hmm. So if you had to step in or you're upset or something happened with a student that you care about, and now not only are you trying to be in the situation and help them, but you have to think through, wait, I'm upset or I'm angry or I'm tense and stressed. So do you have any practical tips for helping adults manage their own emotions mm-hmm. when they're in those situations?
Yeah, I think that recognition is really key for adults. We should be able to recognize those physical aspects of the high emotion. But I think we also need to recognize what it does to us emotionally. So like, that's what it does to us physically, right? Mm-hmm. So we need to be able to recognize that so we can see it at the very beginning. There's something called a reticular activating system. I know this is a big word. We're just going to call it RAS. Mm-hmm. Okay. Because it doesn't matter what the science is. But what it does is it amplifies your negative feelings. Mm. And it's a protection, right, thing. And so it makes you hyper aware of the things that confirm the negative emotion that you just experienced. I'll give you an example for an adult. So we're in a meeting and we're sitting around a table with some other people. We start to give our opinion about whatever topic is at the table. Someone interrupts us. They give their opinion. I've now been triggered because I've been interrupted. I didn't get to finish my story. My voice wasn't heard. Mm. All the things, mm-hmm. right? So even a small thing like that. So I'm triggered. Now, what I begin to watch for is, does nobody care about my opinion? Mm. Am I not wanted here at the table? And I'm looking for confirmation for how I'm beginning to feel about it.
Oh, interesting.
So what happens to me is then when nobody looks back at me or says like, oh, you got interrupted.
Finish your thought, right?
Nobody says finish your thought to me. So now I'm like, oh, well, nobody wanted to hear me. So not only did that person interrupt me, so now they're the aggressor, right? So then I'm watching them. Well, they never looked back at me, or they did. They gave me a side eye. I'm just looking for confirmation of how I feel because that's what my brain's doing, right? So can we figure out, can we identify those times where you could put a stop to those things, right? To the continuation of the negative feelings. And that's the beginning, knowing what happens in your body and then recognizing if you're having, you know, that type of thing, RAS happened to you. But then the next piece is, okay, then what do I do with it?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because, okay, I can recognize it. I can even know I'm starting to feel bad and then it's getting worse, right? Because of
better.
What I'm experiencing.
I'm going to plot against this
person
now.
But how could I really make it better?
Right.
So here's a couple of things. Identify what your triggers are ahead of time.
That's
think about them. What things really bother me? So I don't like diagonal walkers. Okay, because they're intentionally walking diagonal across the street and it's taking twice as long. They could go straight across and I could go past in my car quicker. I'm impatient. I know that right. about myself, uh-huh. right? So diagonal walkers irritate me. All right, so, note but if self. I know that, I know, it's just a thing. But if I know that about myself, when somebody starts to go diagonal across the street in front of me, then I turn on the music. I talk about something else. Mm-hmm. I'm not focusing on them, mm-hmm. right? To be able right. to lessen that trigger.
Yeah.
And so there are things that we can do, even for little triggers. Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of us have much bigger mm-hmm. triggers, right? Because we've been hurt before. Mm-hmm. So on those things where it's something bigger, we have to be self-aware. We're going to have to choose space. I'll tell you what I mean about that. So choosing space gives you that moment before you react that allows you to respond to people rather than react. So lots of times that's taking a breath. Somebody says something sassy to you or they say the one thing, like lots of people don't like to hear the word no, mm. right? Kids sure. don't like to hear the word no. But if they say something, you know, in that, if you can just give yourself a little bit of space to consider your mm. response, that really helps. Not everybody is good at that. And so if you're not intentional enough to give yourself space, you might want to practice inside your head naming the emotion that comes up for you. Okay, so naming something actually gives your brain something else to do. Mm. And it's like counting backwards from 100 by right, sevens. Right. Mm-hmm. It gives your brain something else to do. So any of those techniques, lots of people are like, well, count to three or hold your breath or do the four corner breathing. There are tons of things right, you can right. do. Mm-hmm. It's the same sort of things that we do to help people soothe themselves when they have anxiety, mm. right? So name five things in the room you can see, mm-hmm. four that you can hear, three, right? So right. there are all these great techniques. They work for high emotion too, mm. because it gives your brain something else to focus on in that space. Just distraction doesn't work, but if you actually give your brain that moment to think about something else, then sometimes it can for people.
Because we talked about that 90-second deal earlier. That's we meant that in the context of teenagers. That's just as true for an adult.
Mm-hmm. Oh, 100%.
Right. Yeah.
And for teenagers, they might not be the one choosing after that because maybe the emotion's away from them. Adults get to choose after the 90 seconds whether they're going to continue the strong emotion or not.
Right.
So again, I'm going to back up to another point you made, and this is probably hard in the moment, but if we can be curious of why did I trigger? What was it? And then start to try to figure that out, be a detective, learn those mm-hmm. things, because once we do that, it's much easier to help someone else when in their distress or in their whatever that they need to figure that out.
Yeah. Being the non-anxious presence,
yeah.
if you can find calm in yourself, even in times where you're distressed, when there's a distressing event, mm-hmm. if you can maintain some semblance of self-awareness mm. and calm, you can help other people.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But if you let yourself get consumed by the high emotion, then you're not any use for other people. And especially like as adults, we've got to be able to do that so that we can help our teens mm-hmm. regulate themselves.
What I think sometimes adults put pressure on themselves too is that I have to pretend like I'm fine and move forward and maybe even not acknowledge it. And when we're talking to teenagers especially, you have an opportunity to model for them, hey, maybe you even say, hey, that I'm a little triggered right now, or I'm feeling tense. And so I need a minute to take a deep breath before I continue this conversation. And I think sometimes we see that as a weakness, but mm. really you're showing that teenager and you're modeling, mm. here's how you can do this well.
Yeah, I love that word, like don't pretend. Right. Mm-hmm. Don't pretend everything's okay, because then you're modeling that to them. Mm-hmm. Now we have to pretend everything's okay. All right. Well, the other thing is the going cold. Some people will go like, okay, I'm not going to show any emotion. Well, that's not good because then they think it's not okay for them to show emotion to you. Mm. And that's the opposite of what right. we want for our kids.
Yeah. Right.
Like we need for them to be able to be safe, to show emotion. And that's what being curious, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Helps do that.
Okay. So in the context of teens, so that is how we can help de-escalate ourselves. How can we then move on to helping them do that for themselves and de-escalate their own emotions?
Yeah. So de-escalating Helping other people de-escalate their emotions, a little bit trickier, right? Because we're not in their head. Mm-hmm. Like, release for ourselves, we're in our head, but not in their head. But you can do some things that are soothing to other people. And I would say for teens, don't abandon them. Mm-hmm. Man, first thing, right? Being present. Mm-hmm. That's what teen life's all about. Can we be present for kids? Mm-hmm. Well, when they're in distress or high emotion, sometimes we're like, man, you just need to go in the corner and sit or go to your room. Or, but that's not what they need.
Right.
They need us to be present, right? And then to help them regulate it. Mm. So if for ourselves, being able to give our brain something else to think about is true for them as well.
Mm-hmm.
So asking questions, not that are directly about the event that triggered them, but right. questions around it. So kids upset because they got left out, right? They see an Instagram post, all their friends mm-hmm. are at whatever event, mm-hmm. they were not invited. Okay, so that's their event, you're with them, and they get really, really upset. They either get angry, they're throwing things there, or they're crying, whatever it is. Then maybe the questions around, what would you like to do with your friends if on a later date? Like, again, just thinking about anything else. Or which of your friends are you missing out the most on being with? Anything that'll kind of be, you don't want to go to a totally different topic because then it dismisses why they're upset.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
That's good.
But you want to be around it.
Mm-hmm.
So getting them to think or talk about something else, if they are not capable of that, because sometimes teens are not capable of having a conversation when they have really, really high emotion, mm-hmm. then sometimes it's just a being quiet but being with them.
Mm-hmm.
Again, depending on the situation, if you're a parent, right, then a touch, depending on the kid. I had one that doesn't want to be hugged, but others that want to crawl in your lap, right? So you got to know your kids. But as a school professional in doing that, then you can use a little bit of distraction. So what's true about super high emotion when it consumes a teen or it consumes an adult is that sometimes outside stimulation can break that. So it could be just as easily like clapping your hands together, but saying something soothing with it. Like, and I know that seems weird, but like if you have a clap and you're like, man, I really want to be here for you. But again, like that noise, right, that can disrupt their whatever emotion's going on. This is very true. I did suicide prevention for a long time and talked on suicide hotlines to people. And one of the things when people are getting close to thinking about that, if you can distract them, it distracts that process in their brain.
Mm-hmm.
So then they have to rethink about it, right? So it gives you time to talk to people and give them hope.
Mm-hmm.
So anybody with really, really high emotion or distraction in that area can help. The other things that might be really good to do with teens is to reorient them somewhere else. I know that seems weird, but like when I forget things and I'm like, man, what I come in the room for? If you'll go back out the doorway and then come back in, sometimes you remember.
Right.
And it gives your brain that reset.
Mm-hmm.
So if the kid is in the hallway and they've just gotten in a fight, sometimes then going into a classroom or into the counselor's office or reorienting where they are will give them the ability to then reorient what's going on inside.
Mm-hmm.
That's I don't good. Know why, you know, the science behind that, but it's just true.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I've seen that work for people. There's lots of little things. This begs the question, though, are we willing to step into those spaces?
Mm-hmm.
Man, and just kids are worth it. And
yeah.
so
yeah.
that being willing to find what works is a lot of trial and error.
Mm-hmm.
That's good. Okay, kind of to wrap up, you've talked a lot about how we can help and how we can step in. But the reality is that adults aren't always there. And there are going to be times that our teenagers are in the middle of a friend or in crisis, or they're in a hallway and there's a fight, or they're, I don't know, there are lots of situations where our teens are by themselves without an adult. So do you have kind of as a final push, what can we tell our teenagers so that they know, hey, here's when I need to get help, or how I know if I should intervene or not?
Yeah. I think giving them the confidence that they can make that decision is super important at the beginning, right? So you can tell them, hey, if we're not there, there's no adult there, you have the ability to make the decision, but there are two decisions, right? Mm. You either intervene Well, I guess there are three. You walk away,
right? Yeah. Sure.
You walk away, you intervene, or you get help. Mm-hmm. And I think to be able to differentiate between whether or not I get help from an adult or somebody else or emergency services or whatever, or whether I can intervene, we need to teach them to recognize when emotion tips over into uncontrolled. Mm. So lots of kids yell, scream, swear, throw things, right?
Yes.
But there is a point when they are no longer in control of what they do. Mm. And I think when I've talked to my kids about that, in recognizing that in their friends, whether or not they can actually like, hey, man, like, let's just go get a, you know, Slurpee, or, hey, let's just leave this, you know, stop talking to them. We can walk away. You can intervene in things when things are under control. When they're out of control, it's better to get help. And so the fine line there is when someone no longer recognizes who their friends are and who the foes are. Mm.
They're swinging no matter who's
coming. Yep. They're swinging no matter who's coming. Mm-hmm. So can we recognize when my friend doesn't differentiate between that we're friends or not, or that they're just angry at everybody? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that when kids come up to a fight, you also need to recognize, has it gone past pushing, right?
Right?
Because if there are already punches or there's several people involved, right, that might be beyond what you can intervene in. Mm-hmm. Now, if you're captain of the football team, you might be able to still intervene in freshmen who are tussling. And again, a lot of it depends on your force of personality as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's some people who are so well-liked, everybody wants to do the right thing for them.
Right.
But if you're just in a situation where you don't have that equity, then I've told my kids, like, you have to recognize when you're no longer going to be helpful to them. And the best way that you can be helpful is to get an adult or get help. Mm-hmm. In those spaces. And it's okay to do either one. You're still helping that person.
Right.
Because you don't want them to get to the point where they hurt themselves or hurt somebody else. Because there's some things you can't come back from.
Right.
And I'm like, if you can get help for your friend before they go past that, then you're helping their whole life.
Yes.
That's good.
That is good. Well, thank you again, Brenda, for everything that you've talked about and walked us through and just using your experience to help our listeners. And if you are listening, we hope that you are already subscribed to the Teen Life Podcast, but you can subscribe on YouTube, wherever you listen to podcasts, and make sure you come back next week for more questions and topics covered to help you connect with teens.